Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Holly Black. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I am also an author of science fiction and fantasy and a publisher as well. My next novel is The Tangled Stars, which you can pre-order now. It'll come out as an ebook from Daw Books October 17th or 18th, and it is available for pre-order now. So please do that. Go to Amazon or your favorite online bookstore and pre-order The Tangled Stars. It's a far future humorous space opera caper romp with a AI uplifted genetically modified talking cat as one of the main characters. And if that doesn't get you to get over there and pre-order, I don't know what will. The other thing I wanted to mention is that if you are a Canadian citizen or resident, the voting is now open for the Aurora Awards, which is Canada's basically the equivalent of the Hugo Awards. It's nominated and voted on by fans. And I'm up for two awards this year. This podcast, The World Shapers, is a finalist for Best Fan-Related Work, and my YA novel, Star Song, published by Shadowpaw Press, my publishing company, is up for Best YA novel. It's a very Heinlein, Andre Norton-style science fiction novel, which I also urge you to check out. You can find out everything that Shadowpaw Press is doing at shadowpawpress.com. And in addition to that book and some of my backlist material, and of course, the Shapers of Worlds anthologies that feature authors who were guests on this podcast, two of those are out now, and the third one will be out this fall. I've got all the stories in, and I'm editing them now. It was kickstarted earlier this year. In addition to those books, I'm moving out of science fiction and fantasy a little bit as well. So I have... on what I call the premier side, which is original work, there's a novel by Matthew Hughes, who was a guest of the podcast, but this particular YA book is not science fiction or fantasy. It's called The Emir's Falcon. There's a historical novel called Thick Wood, which will also be coming out this fall, ebook, print, and audiobook, both of those. I also have a picture book that just came out, or will be out this week, actually, as I record this. Called What If You Could. It's by Lynn Harley, and it's it was an interesting project. It came to me very, very quickly. Lynn is currently biking across Canada. She's headed to Montreal, and she is raising funds for Jack.org, which is a youth mental health initiative. She has a page there at Jack.org where people can donate money. She hopes to raise $100,000. And a portion of all sales of What If You Could, this new picture book, which is about a butterfly that has to overcome self-doubt in order to become a caterpillar has to overcome self-doubt in order to become a butterfly. Some sales of this will go to Jack.org as well. So you can check all that out at shadowpawpress.com. And as for The Tangled Stars, you can read a little bit about it on my website, edwardwillett.com. You can also find it, of course, as I said, on all the bookstores now available for pre-order. All right. Well, I guess there's one other thing I should say, which is if you're wondering why it's been a bit longer than usual between podcasts, I was away. And actually, I was in Montreal, although I did not bicycle there. And also Mont Tremblant, which is a ski resort north of Montreal. And some time in Ottawa as well. So I had a great time. And although I had initially thought I would get this podcast out last Sunday, we had just gotten back and I just decided it could wait a week. So that's why there's been a slightly longer gap than usual, but not to worry, I'm back on schedule. And what better way to get back on schedule than with this episode's guest, Holly Black. Holly Black is the number one New York Times bestselling author of fantasy novels, including the novels of Elfheim, The Coldest Girl in Cold Town, The Spiderwick Chronicles, and her adult debut, which we'll be talking about on this podcast, Book of Night. She has been a finalist for an Eisner Award and the Lodestar Award, and the recipient of the Mythopoeic Award, a Nebula, and a Newbery Honor. Her books have been translated into 32 languages worldwide and adapted for film. And she currently lives in New England with her husband and son in a house with a secret library. So, Holly, welcome to the World Shapers.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for being on. I always try to find some connection, but I can't actually find one. We may have been at a convention at the same time at some point, but we've never met or anything. So this will be fresh for both of us. Well, I'm going to start, as I warned you, by taking you back into the mists of time.
Okay.
And tell me about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where did you get interested in writing? How did you get interested in writing? It probably started with reading. It does for most of us. So tell me all that stuff.
Okay, I grew up on the Jersey Shore, back before that had any particular significance. about 5 miles from the beach. And so it's close to Asbury Park. It's a town called West Long Branch. And I was a big reader as a kid, and I wrote, and I, you know, just, you know, I wanted to make up some stories that, you know, that of the sort I wanted to read. But the essential tragedy of the writer is that you can never experience your own work like a reader.
Yeah. Do you remember any of the books that were particularly made an impact on you as an early reader?
Yeah, definitely. I really loved the Wrinkle in Time series.
Oh, yes.
And then I read, there's like a series that starts with Meet the Austens, which is essentially a realistic fiction series.
I read everything by
okay. Madeline Lingle. So you know the moment when you think you've been reading realistic fiction for, like, I don't know, 5 books or something, and you realize you're in the same world.
Yes.
I mean, it had a huge impact on me as a kid. It, like, blew my tiny mind. And it, that feeling of the world getting bigger and stranger really stuck with me. I really love the Prydain Chronicles.
Another favorite of mine.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that led sort of inevitably to reading Lord of the Rings, you know, in junior high. And, you know, really loving those. And I read all those Shannara books.
I only read one.
I was a youth.
And I remember reading the first one and thinking, this is an awful lot like Lord of the Rings.
I read the second one first. I think I bought it sort of randomly out of the adult part of the bookstore. And I think it's probably the first adult book I bought. And so I started with Elfstones, which was so tragic. Well, and then I went back to Sword and was like, this seems very different.
Well, maybe I should have done that. I don't know. On the Prydain Chronicles, I read those out loud to my daughter, and she did not like Taryn. She didn't like him as a character. Princess Aelinwy was always her one that she really loved, but she found Taryn a little hard to warm up to. She just thought he was kind of dumb at times.
I reread them recently too, because I was going to write an introduction, I think, to Taryn Wanderer, which is a weirdly existential book. And I remember thinking that they're really allowed to be mean to each other in interesting ways.
That's true, yeah.
And I wasn't sure how people would react to that, because it's really not a pattern you see too commonly, you know, in modern middle grade.
But of course, those came out in the 60s originally, mm-hmm. I believe. So mm-hmm. I came to them, actually, I think I was college age when I read them, which might have influenced my take on them as well. But I read them to my daughter when she was about 12 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So when did you start writing then? You said as a child, but how young mm-hmm. a child?
I definitely remember writing in fourth grade. I remember actually, like, because I remember there was a writing contest and there was a drawing contest. And I remember my best friend winning the drawing contest and me thinking, well, forget drawing then. Let's stick to this writing. I've done well.
It's in some ways it's easier. At least it feels like it's easier at some point in your life. It's easier to write than it is to draw. But later you find out that they are both difficult in their own way.
Well, my mom was a painter. My best friend was an artist. My husband is an artist.
Oh, there you go.
So I really felt, when I first met writers, I was like, thank goodness, people surrounded by painters.
Did you immediately start writing fantastical things? Was that where you always went to first?
Yeah, never wrote realistic fiction. I read some, but I think I read more realistic fiction now than I did as a kid. I really gravitated to fantasy. Especially high fantasy. It took me a while to sort of come back to contemporary fantasy.
Well, there was a time, well, certainly when I was growing up, it was hard to find anything that you'd call young adult fantasy. Like Friday and Chronicles were there, but I remember desperately looking for fantasy stories that involved young people. And so you ended up reading the adult fantasy, but, and of course that's not a problem anymore. There's a lot of it out there now.
Yeah. But I think people read then I think they read both at the same time. Like, I think there was much less of a sense of once you cross over, you know, you can't cross back. I mean, and I remember, I also, I think, let's see, cause junior high, I was reading, sorry, I was reading the Lord of the Rings, but I was also, that's when I ran into Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, yes.
In a totally different direction.
That's for sure.
I was trying to think, wait, what did I read next? Oh, right. I read all of those books.
Did you show your writing to anyone early on? Did you share it, or was it just something you did for your own pleasure to begin with?
I shared some of it, and then I had in school, I think, I had like tested into one of those. We pull kids out because they tested high on stuff.
Oh yeah, me
classes,
too.
and in that I wrote a novel, a very short, very bad novel called Knights of the Silver Sun, which I believe I meant moon. And it was about all the things that I liked at that point. So there was an evil dragon whose name was Venthromax, which I thought was like the greatest name ever. And there were vampires who were being imprisoned by Venthromax. There were adventurers who were going to. And I've read this many times to great hilarity. It's terrible. It's legitimately so bad it comes around to be funny.
Have you ever done at a convention? Have you read it out loud? That kind of writers reading their juvenilia kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, I have.
Those are always fun.
I love them. They're really one of my favorite things.
I was on one with, Connie Willis was on there, but she didn't really read her juvenilia. She read, she started out writing True Confession, so she read one of those. That was fun. Did you have any teachers or adults who were encouraging you with your writing during that time?
Yeah, I mean, the teacher who ran that program was named Mrs. Prout, and she was great. She really did want us to do creative stuff. She did a unit on poetry, and she did, you know, this novel writing thing. And there was way more arts funding when I was a kid. And so there were things you could go to. Like if you wrote a story and you submitted it, you could win basically going to a college where the state sponsored some kids to like have a day where they did creative stuff. And it was really like really, really different. In that sense, I think about it a lot because I grew up with a bunch of people who, got into bad stuff. I knew a lot of ne'er-do-wells. I knew some people who wound up going to jail. And I really think like a huge part of why I went to college was writing and these writing programs. And the idea that maybe I could meet more people who cared about the stuff I liked.
So when you went to college, well, first of all, where did you go? But what exactly did you study?
I went to Temple first. And then I went to what is now the College of New Jersey. My dad was, he really was trying to gamify it. I went to both those places. I studied English and then switched briefly to teaching because College of New Jersey is largely a teacher's college. And I thought maybe I need some kind of job. And then I remembered that I hate and fear people. And also I'm not good at getting up in the mornings and also curse a lot. And so I dropped out of that and went back to and went back to English.
Probably a good choice.
I also remember, though, reading the Year's Best that Terry Winling and Ellen Datlow put together. Mm-hmm. And I was reading through it and I started looking at the biographies and realizing all of these people knew one another. And I thought, I want to know these people. Like, I want to know people. I want a community of writers. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go into publishing.
And when you were studying English, I often ask this question. Mm-hmm. Did you have creative writing courses, and were they of any use to you? I get varying answers to that question.
I mean, I did, and they weren't bad or anything. Like, I don't have a terrible experience. I actually have an experience of one of the people, one of the teachers I had during that time, because I got to do it twice, because I did it once at Temple, and then when I transferred, I could do it again. But you could really only do one class in creative writing often. Like, there wasn't a program. And I did, I remember this guy was talking about want lines, about how want lines pull the protagonist through the story. And I thought, that doesn't seem true. And like many years later, I'm like, man, I listened to that guy then. But I could not get it through my thick head.
So you decided you wanted a community of writers. How did you then move on into becoming a published writer, and what happened in the interim?
Well, I did go into publishing, but I went into medical publishing. I was first an assistant there, and then I was a production editor in medical journals. And I got involved with a gaming magazine, D8 magazine, that some guys in Philly were putting together. And so I did some interviewing of various people who were creating, you know, tabletop games back then, and helped put together this magazine. And was trying to figure out what I wanted, like how to be a writer.
Presumably writing through all that time.
Yeah, you would think, but that seemed hard. did not seem as intuitive. I mean, I was trying to write, and I did not know how to finish stories. I really didn't. I kept starting them, seeing what was wrong with them, and not taking the very good advice that people often give, which is to get to the end. Hmm. And so I would get to a certain point, and I would abandon it. And then I decided I was going to work on a novel, which, you know, at least you could get to a longer point before you abandoned
it.
And so I started my first novel, which I rewrote basically over the next, I don't know, 5-6 years. And that actually was my first novel, which was Tithe. It went through many permutations. Many people's names changed. The plot changed. Probably every part of it changed, but I did finally get to the end, and I thought, this seems like a book-shaped object. Like, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I have finally figured out what those things are, at least in the context of this novel. But it was true that after that, I was able to write short stories, because I finally sort of figured out for me what stories were.
Did you think of it as a young adult? I mean, it was rewarded as a young adult novel. But did you think of it as a young adult novel when you were writing it? Did you know you were writing young adult? Or
I did not. I thought I was writing an adult book because, you know, I've read many, many books about 16-year-olds who went on adventures. And I thought, you know, it's a book about a girl who discovers she's a fairy changeling. And it seemed to me that discovering that at 30 would make her seem like, you know, maybe not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And so, you know, it seemed like a journey of discovery of selfhood that took place younger. And I had a friend who was a children's librarian at the time, and she said, I think you're writing a young adult book. And I was like, surely not. You know, there's a lot of violence in this book. There's a lot of cursing. And she said, you know, you haven't read young adult in a long time. It's really different. And she gave me Garth Nix and Tammy Pierce. And I thought, I don't know what this is, but I remember reading Cyberland thinking, this is one of the best magic systems I have ever read.
Yeah,
this
me too.
Fascinating. Like, what? Bells? And just so beautifully done. And I thought, okay, yeah, sure, I'll be part of this. And so through doing that gaming magazine, I had become friends with Tony Dottolizzi, who is an artist and who was working in Dungeons & Dragons at the time, but then moving into picture books. And so I knew his editor, Kevin Lewis, a little bit, and I asked Kevin if he thought that if he could tell me sort of what a young adult book was and whether I might be writing one, and he said he would take a look at it. And he wound up buying it.
And launched 1,000 ships. No, launched launched 1,000 books. Not quite, but...
Young adult was so different then. Like, it sounds, you know, it sounds weird to think, oh, you know, you talk to an editor and they could buy a book. But at the time, you didn't have to be agented to submit in kids. It just really wasn't as big of a publishing platform or industry or, like, you know, And certainly young adult wasn't. The year between Tithe coming out and Spiderwick coming out, I tell the story all the time. I went to a SCBWI convention, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators.
Yeah.
It's a long acronym. And I guess everyone was told to network. And so I was standing in line for the bathroom, and a person asked me, what do you write? And I said, oh, you know, I had my young adult book come out. And they turned around and talked to a different person, because everybody knew young adult was, you know, not the category anyone wanted to be in. It made no money. You know, everyone wanted to write either middle grade or especially picture books.
I guess that was my problem. I always wanted to write young adult. And after that, until Book of Night, you have been writing young adult and middle grade. And mm-hmm. So how did your career develop from there up to the present?
I wound up writing the Spiderwick books with Tony. He had wanted to do this field guide, and one of the books that I didn't talk about that I read as a kid, but which had a huge effect on me, and which, you know, in many ways is probably the thing that pushed me into the career I have today, is it's an illustrated book, Fairies, by Brian Trout and Alan Lee.
I remember that.
And my mom had it because she was a painter, and I read it and, you know, looked through the pictures, and you know, they're scary. They're scary fairies, and they're these great folkloric stories, and they made a huge impression on me, and that was my idea of what fairies were. And so when Tony talked about, if anyone is listening to this and has no idea what this book is, imagine Alan Lee, who did the concept art for Lord of the Rings, and Brian Froud, who did the concept art for Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, together in the 70s in a tiny English town, making a book on absolutely terrifying and beautiful fairies. Go find it immediately. It's amazing. But so when Tony was talking about making this field guide, you know, for kids, I really wanted him to do it. And so I wound up working with him on it. And that's sort of how we wound up doing Spiderwick. And that then, you know, consumed a great deal of time. And so I was sort of bouncing between, you know, doing middle grade and then doing my YA books, all of them at that point about fairies.
What do you appreciate most about writing for young readers?
They do not have as clear a sense of genre as older readers do. I think that, you know, when we as adults read, we think of, like, we don't think of fantasy as a genre. We think of it as having many, many subgenres. And often we think we know what we like, and we read in a fairly narrow sphere.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, readers who are coming to fantasy for the first time are much more willing to go weird places and to blend genre and to not even think of it as doing anything unusual.
It's just a book. It looks cool.
Right. I mean, because you are defining the parameters of fantasy for them. You know, these are the books that then they will sort of look at definitionally. And so that's great. I think that they are very, very willing to tell you if they like something and very willing to put it aside if they don't. And I think that they are, when they are enthusiastic, really immensely joyfully enthusiastic about books.
Yeah, I've done, as I'm sure you have, you know, school presentations, mm-hmm. and it's always, the questions are always interesting and the reactions.
Yeah.
I was at a, I remember at a school once, and I think it was a Catholic school, and this kid said, "You had a swear word on page," and he gave me the page number and the paragraph. And I said, "Yeah, well, the character just felt like they had to use that word at that point." It was funny. But you have now moved to writing an adult book, your first one, at least, is, mm-hmm. you may have thought you were writing an adult book, but this is the one that was released as an adult book. So this brings us to talking about your creative process. Where did this book come from? And before we even talk about that, maybe you should give a brief synopsis of Book of Night without giving anything away. I must say it has one of the creepier magical things I've run across. So.
Thank you. Book of Night is about a woman named Charlie Hall who has spent half her life as a thief of grimoires in which shadow magicians called Glomists write down their techniques. And she is trying to quit all that after some bad stuff happened and just be content being a bartender and living with her shadowless and possibly soulless boyfriend and her sister, who is way too hungry for her shadow to quicken. And all that is going medium well until some of her past returns, and it turns out she's not the only one keeping secrets.
Yeah, it's the idea of the shadows being kind of almost like entities of on their own. That it reminded me of Peter Pan, I admit.
Mm-hmm.
Was that one of the influences? Where did the idea come from? There's the classic question.
Okay, it came from a couple places. I mean, certainly we have some sense of what shadows are. So it came from, one thing was, there was a folklore story that I read when I was doing fairy research, and a woman falls asleep on a hill. And when she wakes up, there's a little man with scissors cutting away at her shadow, and she jumps up and he runs off, and she is left with the feeling that if he had managed to do it, something terrible, but you know, she has no idea what would have happened. And then, you know, the other thing was just, you know, coming back from town and seeing my son sort of watch his shadow get longer and shorter and bifurcate, and just the delight in it, but also the sense of like, this is a magic we all see. We all feel there's something weird about it. There's something that feels, you know, magical about it. There's something about the way we manipulate shadow puppets and the way we can jump at our shadows that, you know, I think it feels like it should be more magic than it is, which is an area of writing that I, you know, an area of magic building that I really like. But then, okay, in 2016 or early 2017, I got my ears pointed by a body modification person. So my ears are actually pointed, and a guy named Sampo von Cyborg. And when I went out to have it done, so the person in front of me apparently was living as a vampire. And I, at the time, I was feeling like probably I was the, you know, I was feeling like, oh, I guess I'm, you know, probably one of the older people coming down to do this. I certainly am probably one of the people who has gone, you know, straight to ear modification past a lot of other sort of medium things that I could have done. And so I said, oh, yeah, that's a young man's game, living as a vampire. And they were like, no, he was 50. But he was looking really good. I thought, oh, okay. But I became fascinated with the idea of traveling around the world doing modifications. And so my first idea for the book was somebody who was traveling around the world doing shadow modifications. And so that's sort of how I came into Book of Night, with that sense of the magic system, and then with some sense actually of Vince's storyline. And went on a writing retreat with a bunch of writers, but particularly my friend Kelly Link. And I would write chapter one of this book by night, and I would give it to her by day, and she would be like, okay, this seems good. And then I would delete it, and I would start again. And I did it over and over and over, and I just could not figure out how to get into the book. And so, yeah, to your question about writing, I need to, for me, write some of that, at least some of the first chapter, that feels right.
And this applies to all your books?
Yes, tonally, aesthetically, like, I need to understand what it sounds like, what it feels like, until I can figure out more about the story. You know, I have pieces going in, but however many pieces I have, and some of them are often like a feeling or an image. But I need that beginning to be right in some way.
So it sounds like ideas for you can come, as with most writers, can come from everywhere.
Yeah.
And then they kind of combine together and meld and mix in your head, and then you have to work out what you're going to do with them. Is that a fair description?
Yes. I mean, right. We often think of of the question of, you know, where did this idea come from? But books are so many ideas. You need so many ideas per book.
Yeah. A short story maybe can more often be a single idea that you're working out in, you know, 5,000 words or something. But even if you start with a single big idea for a novel, there's a whole bunch more ideas have to come in before you can have a novel. That's just too big a piece of story to not have multiple things going on. What made you decide, or when did you discover, that it was going to be an adult book as opposed to a YA book? Or did you know that right from the beginning?
I knew it from the beginning because I had thought about the characters as adults. And I think that you're just in such a different place. You have such a different set of questions. You have such a different set of then experiences. And I was really interested in writing about things that I hadn't had an opportunity to write about before. I was interested in writing about that period, in your late 20s, where, you know, you had an idea about where you wanted to go, but now you've arrived at a different place. And, you know, Charlie's stuck. She made a lot of bad decisions, and she feels very much like she's at the end of a road, rather than, you know, characters who are at the beginning and making those first bad decisions. and that sense of stuckness, that sense of stagnation that I think comes into us in adulthood, where, you know, it's really hard to move out of place. You know, we have bills, we have a job we have to show up for every day, we have family obligations. It means that we have less flexibility and less opportunity for transformation, and it means we have a much less positive view of chaos.
Yeah, it's interesting because if I think about it, most YA is about young people making bad decisions, but often what happens is out of those bad decisions, something better and more positive for the future arrives because they're flexible and they can have more opportunity to change. But yeah, by the time you're older, it does get much harder to change anything. First, I did want to mention, because I'm not sure it was clear from the synopsis, that although it has magic, it's not a fantasy realm. It's taking place in something that's basically our world, but with shadow magic, because you've got even, you know, like Five Roses whiskey and things like that, that people, and Grey Goose vodka, I noticed, and things like that, which are, you know, brand names from our world, and yet you have this magic going on. Is that something you like, that mixture of the modern world as we know it and then these magical elements?
I do. I feel like it's one of the things that I came to sort of, you know, after my period of being all in on secondary world fantasy, I became really fascinated with contemporary fantasy, in part because I feel like it meant I could write about my world and also about the stuff I loved, whereas secondary world fantasy felt more distant from the stories I, you know, wanted to tell, I guess, about the people I knew. And, you know, my first books are very much about people I knew, as well as about fairies.
Well, one of the things with contemporary fantasy is, as for readers coming to it, is that, you know, you can immediately recognize these people as you or other people that you know from our world, and you understand perhaps the way they think about things. And I would think that there are some readers that prefer it for that very reason.
Yeah, I think I definitely think that it feels more grounded in certain ways. I think, which is probably what people also don't like about it. You know, it is not, you're not quite as distanced. You're not. But I think it also, for me, gives me that feeling of the idea that magic could be just around the corner. Mm-hmm. That this seems like it really could be true.
Like your shadow could be a magical thing, right, that's attached to you.
Right. And I love that feeling. That if you just turned the right way at the right time, that you could have magic.
Once you had begun and tried these various, do you then do a more detailed outline for the entire book? Or how does the next step work for you when you plunge into the carrying on from what you've worked out in that opening chapter?
So I love sticky notes. I love note cards. I love colored markers. I love the idea of outlining, and I outline, but I never stick to the outline. I cannot seem to outline the book that I'm actually going to write. I outline a book, and then I immediately sort of veer off. And so I have a complicated relationship to outlines. All I want is to make an outline. If only I could make an outline, I would know what happened in the book.
Yeah, it's you know, and as I mentioned to you off the top, this is, I think, 112th one of these. You're the 112th author I've interviewed and basically asked that question. And it certainly runs the gamut from I just start writing and see what happens to, mm-hmm. I always mention Peter V. Brett, who told me he writes 150-page outlines before he writes any of the book. And then he just, you know, he has the whole thing there, and then he just basically fills it in. And I'm nothing like that. So that was interesting to me.
That is fascinating.
With all these sticky notes and everything, it probably tends to have a slight appearance to like the conspiracy theorist bulletin board with all this.
It would if it were not so thin, because I'm not good at really fleshing out outlines in a way that I do think that once you get to a certain size, they probably do seem more book-like, and they probably become more accurate the more book-like they have become. But I have, you know, I got a small conspiracy page on a notebook. And I've been trying the last few years since apparently I will never be able to write a book right until I write it wrong. I've been trying to fast draft books.
How's that worked out for you?
Not bad. I really do think it speeds up the process of making mistakes, which is the goal.
So what does your actual writing process look like then? Are you sit in the chair for 4 hours at a time in your home mm-hmm. office, or do you go out somewhere and write under a tree with a quill pen, or how do you like to work?
I guess my friends, Cassie Clare and Kelly Link, live really close by, and we used to go to Cassie's house almost every day and write before the pandemic. And that's not true anymore. I've sort of tunneled back into my office and have spent much more time actually writing here. But I still do both. And I set sort of a daily word count goal if I'm drafting, or a revision goal, and that's what I have to do in that day, and hopefully I do it. I do kind of timed bursts of writing so that I can then make myself write for that period of time and write continuously. And I'm not the fastest writer.
That was my next question.
So I have to really make sure I'm doing a certain amount of words.
How many do you aim for?
1,000.
In a day?
Yeah.
Well, at the end of, 3 months, you've got a 100,000-word novel. So there you go.
Or if you don't delete half of it.
Well, there is that. Which brings me to revision. So do you complete a draft and then go back and revise from the beginning? Or do you do a rolling revision? Or how do you work?
I like that you're calling it a rolling revision, because mostly I think of it as, like, I, you know, get stuff, go back, rip everything apart and start, you know, and then move forward again. But I like rolling revision. That sounds good.
I think that's what John Scalzi called it when I interviewed him. I think he called it a rolling revision.
I want to, you know, I want to go all the way to the end. I do. But I very seldom am actually able to do it without breaking and going back and starting to fix things. Because I think because in large part, I feel like I am an extrapolative writer. You know, I'm sort of like, oh, well, I've learned these things about these characters. So what would they do next based on the things that I've learned?
And then so that influences what they did in the past. And you have to go back and fix that. So they now match the character that you have discovered as you.
And then I can extrapolate more. So I wind up sort of going back a lot. You know, more than I necessarily ought to, especially because if I get stuck somewhere, I'll just go back. And I find it really satisfying to make scenes better. And I find drafting to be the process of taking a good idea or an idea, at least that I liked once, and turning it into crap.
Yeah, well, that's legitimate. Eventually, though, you must have a complete manuscript.
I do. Eventually, I have a complete manuscript, you know, that starts at much greater quality as a dive down toward the end. And then I have to, you know, spend a lot of time sort of rethinking the end and then going back from that. But I do wind up usually completing the book that I intended to complete by the time I intended to complete it.
Now, you mentioned, you know, sharing a chapter with Kelly Link when you're at this workshop. Do you, on a regular basis, do you have a community of writers that you have, like beta readers or anything like that? Or?
I definitely do. You know, I'll show my friends stuff I'm working on, stuff I'm stuck on. I'll talk through stuff with them. I really love that part of writing. I love being able to talk about story with people. I love to be able to talk about other people's stories with them.
Must be nice.
Always fun. Like, for me, that is one of the most fun things, is having that community and having those kinds of ways of thinking about story. Like, I'm stuck. This doesn't make sense. What should I do?
I think
and then, you know, people will tell you and you'll be like, no, not that. Not that. Okay, maybe that. If I change everything about it.
I'm always interested in that. I think it's because I grew up in a small town, and the only writers group in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, where I grew up, was elderly women writing reminiscences about the Great Depression. So I didn't think my far future space opera about the kid with the alien artifact that he's chasing around trying to find out what it is would probably have gotten much useful feedback from them. And maybe because of that, but I've never really had beta readers or anything. My editor's the first person that sees it, and so, you know, sometimes I wonder what I'm missing. So, because so many authors tell me that it's very helpful to them.
I have great admiration for you being able to get through a book like that, because I feel like I don't know what I would do without my friends.
Once you have gotten all the feedback and you've got a final thing, then it would go to an editor, presumably.
Well... Most of the time at this point, and I think that this is key to the fact that I turn things in when I do, I've usually sold it. Very seldom have I actually, two books at the beginning of my career where I wrote the whole thing first. And then I have written partials when I've sort of moved publishers, but most of the time I am turning this book into my editor at an earlier stage in the process, let's say. Definitely when I have a draft, but not when I have everybody's feedback, usually.
So they're part of the feedback.
Yeah, it's going out. And usually, you know, I try to have at least one draft that I hopefully sent to my friends before I turn it into my editor. But sometimes I'm turning it into my, like a group of readers and my editor at the same time. So I'm getting sort of feedback together.
What kind of feedback do editors typically give you? We all have ticks and things that editors seem to catch that nobody else does. Is there anything like that in your case?
Definitely. I always need to push the antagonists, because I feel like I make a maze. In my first draft is often like the maze. And so the character then, in my second draft, is fighting the plot, because so much of my first draft is figuring out the plot. And so much of my second draft is the character fighting the plot, that so much of my later drafts have to be the plot fighting back. And often that is making the antagonist more powerful and just like turning up the tension. I'm a flincher, you know, I want to make things nice for people. you know, and I have a tendency to write characters who maybe don't say all the things they need to say or do all the things they need to do. First draft of, or an early draft of a Book of Night, there's a scene in it where one of the characters comes in and kills somebody. And in an early draft, they almost killed that guy. Why? Why did they almost kill that guy?
You're just too... just too nice.
I just flinched. And so, you know, so much of it is going through and saying, oh, that thing where they thought, man, I should have punched that person in the face, but I didn't. You know, go back and make them punch them in the face. Like, take everything and, you know, turn it up. Make it worse. Make it harder. Make them do the thing they thought about doing.
Yeah, it's that whole thing of, you don't... We don't want to live in the worlds that we create because of all the horrible things we put characters through. But if, but people who are reading want to live in the worlds that we create because of all the horrible things we put characters through.
Exactly. You know, so yeah, bigger mistakes, bigger, sometimes more twists.
Then you've had, once it is published, you've certainly had success, New York Times bestselling author, and all these awards. Was that a surprise to you when it really took off?
Oh, yeah. I was not a person who thought of myself as writing. I thought of myself as a weirdo. And so I thought the stuff I liked was weird. And it was an immense surprise to realize that there were a lot of people that liked the stuff I liked, and that the weirder the stuff, the weirder and closer to my own place of like a loving story I got, the more universal the story was.
Do you have a back and forth with fans? Are you connected to your fans and online in any way? Or
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the interesting things about, you know, the way our media works today is that we are able to be, you know, we're able to be online. We're able to be accessible in a way that we weren't, which is, it's a mixed blessing.
Yeah.
But it is amazing to see, you know, and hear from readers all over the world who have stuff to say and who, you know, who know the imaginary people that live in my head, which is, you know, it's so good. I'm often like, you know that guy? I know that guy.
One of the cool things about writing for, you know, because so many of your books are for younger readers, is that you get a constant new set of readers as kids are born and grow up to where they're reading and they find your books. Do you hear a lot from some of your earlier books? You get a lot of feedback from young people who have enjoyed them? Or
I think one of the things that has been really surprising in the last few years is, so I just, when I was on tour for Book of Night, I had an event with writer Hannah Witten, who I had never met before, and I read her book. I really loved her book. It was, you know, she was there. She was talking about her kid, and she said, "I read Tithe when I was 14," and I was so surprised. Although, you know, because you know, she is not just she's a full grown adult. And yeah, I had that, like, it was very meaningful and also, you know, gave me a great sense of my own mortality. But now I have readers who read me as kids who are adults in publishing, who are writers. It's very interesting to have been in publishing for as long as I was.
And with the new book being the first adult novel, have you been gratified by the response to Book of Night? It seems to be good.
I didn't know what it would be like, you know, in what way it would be different to to write an adult book. One of the things that partway through freaked me out was that sense of, wait, I actually don't know a ton about subgenres in adult fantasy except from the point of view of a reader. And I'm not sure what kind of micro calculations I'm making and what they mean. Like, what does it mean that this is an open world versus a closed world fantasy? Does it mean anything? How does it change the cover? Like, how does it? And so I wasn't sure about so many things. But yeah, it's been great. We're still, been 5 weeks on the adult times list. One thing I realized is when you're on the adult times list, they move your book to the front of the store. When you're on the kids bestseller list, they're like, good job, I guess. Like, what do you mean? There's a whole section. They just move you to it. Amazing.
Well, this whole thing we were just talking about with having, readers who were teens who discovered you and are now adults, presumably those readers are now coming to your adult novel because they, oh, Holly Black, I always loved her stuff when I was 14, and now here's this. So
I'm counting on them. Counting on them.
Well, we're getting into the last about 10 minutes here, so I wanted to ask the big philosophical questions I warned you about. There are three of them.
Okay.
The first one is, why do you write? The second one is, why does anybody do it? Why do people do this strange thing where they make up stories? And then the third one is, why stories of the fantastic specifically? So those three things.
Okay, so I'm sorry. I thought of them as two until you said three, but it's so, why do I write? Why does anybody write?
And why stories are the fantastic? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You can think of them as however many questions you want.
What's the third question?
Why stories are the fantastic in particular?
I thought that was the second question.
Well, it just depends on how you count them up, so.
I'm lost. All right, but I'm going to do some of these questions. So why do I write? Many people over the years have asked me this because I'm so miserable when I'm writing, which is all the time, because I'm constantly sure that I'm making a mistake and sure there's something missing and something I still have to figure out and something I'm not sure I will be able to figure out. And I feel like there must be a less miserable way of doing this. I think if I enjoyed drafting, I feel like the writers I know who enjoy drafting seem happier, but maybe that is not true. But they seem happy. They're like, I'm writing my draft.
They may be happier during the drafting process, but they're generally unhappy then in the revision process. So, you flip it over.
I guess. That's what I keep telling myself, because it's true that I am happy during the revision process. I think that I love being inside a story. I love figuring out stories. I love making a thing that is the thing I would like, even if I can't enjoy it as a reader. I love making the thing that I would enjoy.
Okay, and why do you think any of us do this, where we tell stories and share them with other people?
Well, I think that stories, in particular fantasy stories, are a way of looking at the world slant. We can't always talk about things in a nuanced way when we're talking about them straightforward. Like when we talk about anger, it's very difficult to think about our own anger, our own desire to hurt people we care about. But when you put it in the context of a werewolf, you're able to get at other questions. You're able to get past the initial block of, well, it's just bad. Well, here's someone who can't help it. So now what? How do you talk about it differently? How do you think about it differently? How do you think about, different outcomes and different approaches? And I think, when I think about magic, I think magic is always about, it is always about something, and then it's also always fantasy. So it can't just be a one-to-one. Like when you write about a werewolf, you can't just be writing about anger. You must be also writing about a werewolf. But I do think that magic has to have some kind of thematic resonance to the story you're telling, and it has to be story generative. So like when I'm writing about shadows, I'm writing about the parts of us we don't want to acknowledge. I'm writing about our shame, our fear, our desire. I'm writing about the question of like, if we could get rid of all those parts of ourselves, then what would we be? Would we still be a vital person? You know, would we still have that sense of life? And I think that that's what I really love about reading fantasy. And I think it's why it's important to write fantasy.
Okay, so you did answer just two questions, because that kind of took the third question, which was why fantastical stories, and put it in with the second question, which was why do we write? So there, you see, it was only two questions. I just didn't know. And what are you working on now?
I'm writing another YA book in my fairy world. So I'm writing a book called The Stolen Heir. And by writing it, I mean I'm editing it, ripping it to pieces right now. And it's part of a duology. So I have two duologies. I have Book of Night duology, and then I have this duology to sort of thread together.
And where can people find you online?
I'm at Holly Black, I think, actually online. I think I managed to be Holly Black at Twitter. And I think I am either Black Holly or Holly Black on Instagram. And, you know, you can go to my website, blackholly.com, and it will give you the right information rather than what I am currently giving you.
All right. Well, I think that'll bring us to the end. So, so thanks so much, Holly, for being on the World Shapers. I really enjoyed the chat. I hope you did too.
I did very, very much. Thank you so much for having me on. I love talking about process. So
I love it too. That's why I started the podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Holly Black for that great conversation. That one was a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. And I hope that you will come back and listen to many more interviews with science fiction fantasy authors going forward. Now, you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers, and you can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. And you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. And you can also find me on YouTube at edwardwillett, youtube.com/edwardwillett. And if you go to YouTube, you can walk along with me almost every day as I walk around Regina. I live stream my walks and I talk about whatever. Sometimes I sing. And I do talk quite a bit about publishing and what I'm working on. So that's something you might want to check out. And also, if you want to see what Regina, Saskatchewan looks like, there's already over a year's worth of videos right through the seasons from summer to winter. Here we are back in summer again. And I have no intention of stopping. So come and join me on my walks around Regina at youtube.com/edwardwillett. I also mentioned Shadowpaw Press. Shadowpaw Press, my publishing company, and all the things that are coming out from there, including Shapers of Worlds Volume 3, featuring third-year guests of this podcast. And I expect there to be a Shapers of Worlds Volume 4, at which point people like Holly Black will be invited to be part of that one. You can find Shadowpaw Press at shadowpawpress.com, which is where you can also buy all these books in either print or ebook format. You can also find Shadowpaw Press on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press. You can find it on Facebook at Shadowpaw Press. You can find it on Instagram at Shadowpaw Press. And it's also on YouTube, although it doesn't have a handy URL. It's one of those complicated ones. But if you do a search for Shadowpaw Press, you'll find the Shadowpaw Press channel there. All right, that will wrap up this episode of The World Shapers. I hope you enjoyed listening. And as I said, I hope you'll come back many times in the future to listen to more great conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about how they go about creating the wonderful worlds and adventures and characters that we have enjoyed down through the years. That's it for this time. Bye for now.